We're going to focus on a set of four, really two of the four, but we'll mention four, ways of approaching childlessness that are now possibilities because of fairly recent technological developments. My name is Charles Lutz. I'm the director of the Office of Church and Society for the American Lutheran Church. I live and work most of the time in Minneapolis. I am not an expert in the area of biomedical concerns, certainly not in the scientific and technological side of that. My field is ethics and theology. That's my training. But I'm interested in this set of concerns. I have with me this morning Dr. Roger Harms, who is seated here, who is from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester and who's had some experience as a medical professional in the area, and he will be correcting me, I hope, when I misstate things, and certainly looking at the issues from a perspective that comes out of his own discipline. And he will tell you more about his background in a few minutes. What I want to do is lay out, first of all, four possibilities that are dealt with under this heading of biomedical ethics, beginning of life questions, or sometimes called procreation ethics, and then state what I think the central ethical considerations are, ethical and theological considerations, then invite Roger to say some things about the same subject matter, and particular to deal with some of the questions about the technologies themselves. And then we want to have time to discuss it all with you, and you can you should feel free to address comments to either of us. Before I forget it, let me mention three books that are available in this general area, and they're all in the bookstore here. Questions About the Beginning of Life, Christian Appraisals of Seven Bioethical Issues. There are bioethical questions about the end of life. We're not dealing with those, nor does this book. We're dealing with beginning of life questions. Here are seven, and they are artificial insemination, in vitro fertilization, what is often called test tube babies, surrogate motherhood, genetic manipulation, genetic screening and counseling, that's basically prenatal genetic screening and counseling, prenatal diagnosis of any kind of disorder, and finally, handicapped newborns. What kind of extraordinary measures, if any, should be used medically to keep alive severely damaged newborns? We're not dealing with all seven of those. This book does. It's a collection edited by Ed Schneider. Ed used to be on my staff. He's now a parish pastor in Illinois. But Ed received the assignment to put this book together a year or two ago. It's a joint effort of the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church departments or offices of Church and Society. There is a collection of essays that are less lengthy and less academic than these. These are all by ethicists and medical professionals. Same subject matter by the same seven people in more popular form. Those are supposedly off the press, and I had hoped to have copies of them here at Holden for this presentation today. They have not arrived. They'll probably be on today's boat. But if they do arrive and you're interested, we'll make those available. And I'll see that Roger watches for them while he's still here so that he can use them later in the week. But this is a good book. It was published a year ago. It's still fairly current, therefore, and I'll be referring to it later. Another book on the whole spectrum of biomedical ethical questions, its subtitle is From Test Tube Babies to Aging, is this one, Life Manipulation by David G. Legray. I do not know this book. I have not read it. I just got it this morning in the bookstore. There is one copy of it left, so whoever gets there first can have it. There are quite a few copies of this. There are a few copies left of Bishop Lowell Erdahl's book, Pro-Life, Pro-Peace, which tangentially touches on this subject matter. This book really deals with what Bishop Erdahl feels ought to be a consistent approach among believers to issues of capital punishment, abortion, war, particularly nuclear war, the threat of nuclear war, and euthanasia or mercy killing. So that may be of interest to some of you. It seems to me the basic questions before us in this ethical area are these. Is procreation as a natural process integral to human identity itself? Of course, when you ask that question, then you immediately have to define what is natural. But as we have traditionally understood the natural process, one woman and one man through sexual intercourse procreating. Is that definition of natural integral to human identity itself? Or can we depart from that naturalness as a way of achieving the possibility of childbearing? That's one question. I think the second question, which is really maybe the first question, it's behind that question, is why do we have children at all? What are the reasons we have children? And it seems to me that for Christians, in addition to the common human reasons of having children, to continue the race, to continue my identity through my children, it seems to me as Christians there's another reason. It is that we believe in God's promises, and therefore we are people of hope. That's why we have children. In fact, you sometimes hear people these days saying, I don't think I want to have children because I don't have any hope about the future. The future looks so bleak, the nuclear future or whatever. You sometimes hear that. It seems to me for Christians there's a basic reason that you have children, and that is because you believe in the promises of God, and that therefore we have a hope about the future, that there will be a future. Related to that question, I think, is the point that very often we feel childbearing is what's important. It seems to me that what's really important about parenting is not the bearing of children, but the rearing of children. So we have to separate, I think, child rearing from child bearing. And if you do that, then you can say, well, I can rear, my wife and I can rear a child who was born by another couple. And we do that when we adopt. Okay, so that's one of the, I don't want to give that so much as an answer as a question. What is important in having children? And is having children limited to the bearing of children, or does it have to do much more with the rearing of children? Now, the concern is childlessness, or what the Bible calls barrenness, the childless couple. About, the estimates are, Roger, you may have better data than I, from my reading, it's 10 to 15% of marriages do not result in the possibility of bearing children by that couple, something in the area of 10 to 15%. Well, that's a sizable number. That's 1 in 10 or 1 in 7 of all couplings do not result in fertility, do not have fertility. What do we say to those people? Do we say, well, for you, the only option is adoption? I'm not so sure that's the only thing that should be said to them by their counselors, whoever they go to for help. About 40% of those childless couples are the result of infertility in the male. There are two forms of, let me go to the board now. I've tried to chart these four options by using the symbol of woman and man, female and male, that are traditional symbols. And that represents the couple. There is a couple. Two of the options I put within the larger circle because they involve the two couple, the two members of the couple, the egg of the woman and the sperm of the man. They do not go to a third party. One is artificial insemination by husband, using the sperm of the husband, but because of either a physical or psychological problem, insemination via intercourse is not possible or is problematic. Or sometimes because the sperm count of the male is too low. From a single ejaculate, you have to pool the sperm from several ejaculates in order to have a large enough sperm count through artificial insemination to create an inseminated egg. That's AIH. And that, because it involves the two of the couple, does not present the same kind of ethical questions that other options will. The other one that's within the circle is in vitro fertilization, where the egg from the woman is inseminated in a, what is usually called a test tube. In vitro, as I understand it, means literally in glass. Isn't that what it means?
Right.
So, in glass. Some of you, how many of you remember reading Brave New World? A kind of negative utopia. I remember that book, and one of the things about the book that I recall is that was in this Brave New World, Aldous Huxley's vision of the awful future, it's a negative view, that society took care of procreation by a test tube. All babies were brought to birth through the test tube. Okay, in vitro fertilization. There are living examples of children who have been born via this technology. I expect they're quite healthy and very happy to be alive. I imagine if you could ask them, they'd say, yeah, I'm glad I'm here. But that can be done also with a third party, but as long as it's done with these two, it's within the circle. It doesn't involve a third party, so I've put it there. Now, there are two other things that I think are ethically more problematic, and maybe we'll spend most of our time on those. One is a surrogate mother using the sperm of the couple and contracting with another woman to be the bearer and the egg provider of a child for this couple. That is being done. The other option I call surrogate father because it's kind of parallel to this, but it's usually not called that. It's usually called artificial insemination by donor. Here, the egg of the couple's woman is utilized, but the sperm comes from another male. Usually because the sperm of this male is not fertile, is not adequate, cannot inseminate the egg. So that's what is usually called AID. Not AIDS, but AID. AID, artificial insemination by donor. Usually the donor is anonymous. Maybe always, Roger. I guess almost always the donor is anonymous, right? Not known to the couple?
Almost always.
Almost always. Okay. How that is done technologically and what sperm banks are and all of that, we'll hear some from Roger about in a few minutes. Okay, so those are four options, and in my mind, you distinguish the two that are in the circle from the two that are outside the circle, because the two outside the circle involve a third party. What else do I want to say about that? Maybe nothing more at this point. Before we conclude, I want to read to you brief excerpts from these writers and where they come out, but I don't want to prejudge our discussion by sharing that now. So I'll hold that and return to it later. So with that introduction, Roger, let me toss it to you and ask you to add whatever you'd like to. I think particularly about the two that are surrogate, third party involved.
Okay.
Well, and give us your background too, would you?
Sure. First of all, I'm Christian, coming out of the ALC tradition, originally from a little town in Nebraska, now Rochester, Minnesota. I am board certified obstetrician gynecologist and am active in our infertility clinic at the Mayo Clinic, specifically at the moment director of our in vitro fertilization program. At Mayo Clinic we provide all of these services with the exception of surrogate mother. I guess just to start out, in medicine too there is a debate that involves what is the status of the infertile couple in terms of they have a problem, do they have a disease? Is infertility a disease? Often diseases may cause infertility, but when you cannot define the cause, when you cannot really ascertain what the reason that a couple is not conceiving is, there's really a debate whether that constitutes a disease or not in terms of our responsibility, according to the Hippocratic Oath, etc., to try to stamp out this disease, if it is one or it isn't.
To cure it, yeah.
Okay, and there is a debate in that regard which impinges upon a lot of social aspects in terms of insurance coverage, etc., where many insurance policies clearly do not state that infertility is a disease which they cover, whereas they it is a disorder perhaps, but they don't classify it as a disease. So from a point of view of a professional sense, there is, I think, a less clearly defined assignment on the part of a physician that you need to provide services to help an infertile couple on the basis of what being a doctor is. On the other hand, from the other argument point of view, this is a sizable proportion of the population, as you alluded to earlier, 10 to 15% of all couples. And when you think about that, that is thousands and thousands of people who want to have children who can't.
And want to have their own biological children.
Want to have their own biological children and are not able to. And it's a painful, an extremely painful thing for those couples. As a matter of fact, from a point of view of the psychological pain that infertile couples go through, I have very little question that it constitutes a disorder, a disease that impinges upon their entire life. And a couple who is suffering from infertility often looks at every menstrual period as another time of mourning. And that mourning period may go through the most of the rest of the month when they finally start to recover and they have another period. Once again, they go into mourning. And this continual process of disappointment, disaster, mourning, recovery is a problem that is very taxing emotionally and physically on this couple. Oftentimes our role in being the most loving, that as using it from my point of view as a Christian term, one of my roles is to tell patients when we've seemed to have done everything that we can do, there's nothing else we can do, it's time to put it behind you. Unfortunately, technology continues offering another carrot to keep going on and on and on and on and keep struggling for that child because there's still a chance. And it's a difficult position to be a counselor in that situation in order to help a couple maybe give up and consider adoption or give up and consider a childless life and yet get through with the mourning period and get back on their road to life, when at the same time you know in your back pocket you have in vitro fertilization to offer as sort of the ultimate experiment in trying to bypass natural methods of attaining pregnancy. So in a way, when that's what I want to tell you about what it's like to be a counselor to the infertile couple. These are people with real needs who look into your eyes with as much pain as somebody who comes in with a backache or with bleeding from the wrong spot. They are just as anxious, just as needful of your services when they come into the office. And I would say that in terms of the question of whether bearing a child and rearing a child is a separable event, I think it is separable. But I think that particularly those of us who are males may not be in a position to say that bearing a child is not an extremely important event that if is maybe not equal to, but certainly plays, has a role up there with rearing children in terms of its rewarding nature in life. So, now, from where we want to go from there, I'm not sure, except to say that technically speaking, just for your background, the ones inside the circle are decidedly less effective than the ones outside the circle.
Less effective.
Less effective. Okay. AIH, intrauterine insemination with the husband's sperm, is uniformly lousy in terms of its effectiveness. If we take all couples who come in to see us in an infertility clinic, I can say without question 20% of them will get pregnant while we're ditzling around trying to figure out what's wrong. Okay. And AIH has had as its effectiveness rate in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% overall. So, you know, are we talking about anything that really makes a difference? In vitro fertilization, although the numbers are about the same, it's a little different because after you've worked with a couple for 5 to 7 to 8 years and they haven't conceived, that 20% is gone. Okay, they no longer have a 20% chance. And in vitro fertilization represents somewhere in the neighborhood of a 20% chance of pregnancy, 10 to 12% chance of carrying a baby home at the end of 9 months. So although these are there and they offer some ethical questions, they shouldn't be construed as very effective. On the other hand, we're trying to get away from AID in terms of artificial insemination by donor, I think for obvious reasons. AIDS and AID is just too close. And since AIDS has been known to be transmitted by the artificial insemination process, we are steering away from that particular abbreviation. We now call it TDI, therapeutic donor insemination, to get around that.
You learned it first here. TDI.
Yeah. Okay. At any rate, if a couple has been tested and the woman is found to be normal in every way and her husband is has oligospermia or azoospermia, meaning a repetitive sperm count that's under 10 million. 10 million sounds great, but normal people have 50, 80, 100 million per cc. So if we're dealing with a clear-cut male factor infertility, TDI, therapeutic donor insemination, has approximately a 80% pregnancy rate within 6 months if you're using fresh semen, and about 80% in about a year if you're using frozen semen for that couple to attain a pregnancy. And so that's quite effective. Surrogate motherhood is less well published. However, suspicions would be that if you pick your surrogate to be a normal person with proven fertility, that you'd end up with close to the same numbers in terms of 70 to 80% success using fresh semen from the husband within the couple. So that from Chuck's statement that those things that are outside the circle are the more questionable ethically, that may be true. They're the most effective, however.
You said you work with this option, but not this option.
Right.
Say why? Because they're equally effective medically.
That's right. Well, several reasons, but I think a distinction can be clearly delineated. In the case of the surrogate father or donor insemination situation, the only thing that you're getting in the bargain is a vial of sperm. In the case of a surrogate mother, really you have an end product to look at. You've got a baby. There's the pregnancy months that have gone by that the surrogate mother has to deal with. There's the handicapped child question. If the contract wasn't drawn up to include babies who are normal versus abnormal or what the situation was, you can end up holding a very nasty bag. And in terms of from a legal sense, the definition of whose child there is, really, as far as from a point of view of, I'm not a lawyer, but in Minnesota at least, you are legally the child of someone who gives birth to you by definition. There are legal statutes that make allowances for whose child you are as a product of donor insemination. But there are no legal statutes at the moment of whose child you are if you are born to a woman who is acting as a surrogate mother, because the definition of whose you are is whose body you came forth from in terms of the female side of things.
Even if there's a contract, a legal contract, does that have legal standing between the couple and the surrogate mother?
It is at least murky. The contract, of course, has some legal standing, but as we all know, contracts are meant to be broken, and lawyers make their livings breaking them. And so, excuse me, there's a little
We're
going to
give lawyers legal time.
But anyway, there was a little jab there I shouldn't have thrown in. But at any rate, I don't think there's any safety in the contract in that regard compared to a legal statute that would say that a child born of a surrogate arrangement is the child of the couple with whom the contract was signed. That has not been passed by the legislature. So it seems psychologically stressful for the surrogate mother. It's on a questionable legal standing. And finally, you have a more measurable end product that the contracting couple is taking when they get the baby than in donor insemination. And therefore, there's the consumer aspects of it, product satisfaction, that you don't have to deal with in donor insemination.
Okay. There's a question back there.
Before you start, maybe you should just briefly explain how donors are selected in TDI. Yeah.
Okay. Donor selection for artificial insemination by donor is a fairly careful process when done by a legitimate institution. However, there is a number of tiers of AID that are evolving. And I'll tell you how it is at our institution, where donors are selected from within the institution. 99% are doctors or medical students. And
that raises certain questions in itself.
That's true.
Why not lawyers?
Because we're the ones who are running the clinic.
And we know you have very special genes.
Yes. No, seriously, that is one of the questions, is that who makes the judgment that that's a good group? But it's a people that we have a certain degree of fingers on while they're there. They're people who, especially medical students, need the money and therefore are available. And since you have, to some extent, an available group who is, at least in the eyes of some, fairly desirable, and somebody that you can follow over a period of time, not only on the dime they're giving the donation, but for several years thereafter, there's some safety in knowing who that person is. However, that person is not known to the couple specifically. And a number of things are tested in terms of the mother's blood type and the donor's blood type so as to make sure that you prevent complications of pregnancy. Genetic counseling goes on so that you wouldn't use a donor who has a cousin with cystic fibrosis in a couple whose one mother has cystic fibrosis, so that you can make certain arrangements so that the donor and the mother are not likely, mm-hmm, by obvious means, to produce a baby who's abnormal. Then after all those criteria are met, then the couple themselves set forth an outline of what characteristics they would like to see. And most commonly, those are characteristics of the father who is going to be the father of this baby in terms of real-life fatherhood. So color of hair, color of eyes, nationality, background.
Get people who want a Norwegian father.
Right.
A donor, if there's a Norwegian father.
Exactly. Exactly. And so you try to match, to some extent, their needs. Now that's sort of your most expensive, ultimate donor insemination you can buy. Okay? And it's the one most commonly available. On the other end of the scale, Southern California is always at the pioneering levels of all these things. And there are some women who have got up frozen sperm banks of anonymous donors who you can go in and purchase the vial yourself, being a woman. And
on the open market,
without a prescription. More or less without a prescription, that's right. And do the insemination at home, like so-called turkey baster babies. And
turkey baster?
Yeah, because that's how the method. So that's sort of the other end of the spectrum of donor insemination.
California leads the way.
California leads the way. Well, My usual speech is, at the very first session when we're talking about this, this is the road of investigation, these are the steps that we can take, and then I say, infertility is not a disease. At any time that you want to say, I don't want to do that test, I don't want to do this, that's fine. It's absolutely fine. You don't have to pursue any of this except to the degree that you personally feel that you need to or want to. And I don't actually delve into their motivations for having children largely at that point. I know the pressure with which you speak because Chris and I were married for 10 years before we had Daniel, and everybody seems to think it's whether you're procreating or not. I think that is a pressure that's there. And I explore with the couple when we get on in this, you know, you've been at it for a couple of years, you say, why are you continuing to do this? And start to get into what their motivations are. After that long time, you start to get a relationship with the couple, and then you can pick up on that and say, well, your reasons should be within you and not from outside, if you hear that kind of thing.
Let me ask the group a question. How many of you feel that in our culture today, having the ability to have or not have children is still linked with failure and success as a human being? And if you don't have children, there's something about you that means you failed. It's in that sense a judgment, a negative judgment. Is that where we are?
Are you asking, are there large groups of society who still feel that way, or the society as a whole?
I'm asking about our society as a whole.
Yeah.
Yes.
The values of our culture.
This culture.
Okay. You don't think it's true of our culture?
Well, I suppose it goes back to being relevant.
Yeah.
For myself.
You don't believe it, and your peers don't believe it. Yeah.
I'm glad I have children. I don't feel that pressure.
How do your parents do?
They love the idea I have children.
Sure. The demographics would indicate that the majority of people don't feel that pressure.
Well, your mother-in-law at 113, she has six kids, and her oldest son isn't giving her anything. She had
all
children to have grandchildren.
would adoption satisfy in this situation?
I don't know. I think what I'm doing in life right now for a lot of other children satisfies me. I don't feel I have to be a mother to be a full human being. And I think down the road, and we have foster children all over the world that we support in other places, but not in our own.
Yeah.
She must be 34, but she's not married. And the pressure on her from her friends and all of us is, why aren't you getting married and have kids? That is tremendous pressure, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Not public pressure.
Well, I think you're lucky if you only have kids before you're selfish. You're your own nice life. You should be
abusing yourself like the rest of us.
Yeah.
Who are not married, right?
Just finding a man.
Many adoption agencies in recent years have turned to placing children for adoption with single parents. Is the Mayo Clinic service available to single women in TDI?
No.
Why?
Because
it's in Minnesota.
That's
in California, it would be.
That's largely the right answer. The Mayo Clinic is a very conservative organization in general, and we, although might want to be on the forefront of frontiers in some ways, we don't want to be on the forefront of other frontiers, even if they've been bridged 10 years ago. But currently, only married women are considered candidates.
Yes.
I have a question that I need Roger to answer. Is the clock running out? Is that a myth?
I'm glad you asked that. Because Good Housekeeping magazine has spread the word that 35 is the end of your childbearing years. And boy, is that an injustice. Because many women are making this decision because their biological clock is running out. Let's look at what the truth is. There are certain risks that heighten your chances for a cesarean section if you have your first baby after age 35. This hardly means death. The second thing is you do encounter an increasing risk for congenital anomalies, specifically chromosomal abnormalities, the most common of which is Down syndrome or trisomy 21. Your risk of having a baby at age 20 is about 1 in 2,000 or so.
A Down syndrome.
Having a baby with Down syndrome.
1 in 2,000 at age 20.
At age 20. At 35, it is significantly increased. It's about 1 in 375. Boy, that sounds pretty bad, right? Only thing is, what chances do we take every day that are as bad as 1 in 375? I mean, that's not all. It's a significant risk compared to what it was at age 20. The reason that 35 was singled out by Good Housekeeping magazine and everybody else is that there's a technology available for detecting babies with congenital abnormalities of this variety called genetic amniocentesis. And physicians more or less arbitrarily selected 35 as the age to start talking to mothers about that, because the risk of knocking off a baby from a genetic amniocentesis is about 1 in 500, so that there is a gap there that at least at age 35 there's a high enough risk for the problem that it justifies doing the test. That's why 35 was picked. Nothing magic. Now, I'm not saying this isn't have some ray of truth to it, because fertility in general falls off with age for reasons we don't know. And if you decide not until age 38 to try to become pregnant, you might be disappointed.
Infertility
goes up. But the apparent feeling that it's almost immoral to have a child over age 35 should be stamped out. At the age of 40, your chances of a baby with Down syndrome is about 1 in 100. At the age of 45, it's about 1 in 20. So it's clearly increasing radically with age. But that's a judgment you can make. That's not something that Good Housekeeping should tell you, that you can't have babies after the age of 35.
What about paternal age?
Paternal age is also a factor, although it's much less well-defined. It appears to be in... From the father's point of view, maybe at the age of 50 to 55, there's an increased risk. But again, it's much, much less well-defined, and I can't tell you the statistics as I can on motherhood. Right. The genetic amniocentesis itself, of course, has a risk to the developing baby of infection causing a spontaneous abortion, and that in the poorest of hands is about 1 in 500. It should be considerably less, maybe in the 1 in 800, but there still consists a risk that in doing the test, you will lose the pregnancy. So that's why it's not offered to you when you're 23 years old, although there are some legal pressures to now offer it to you if you're 23, but the risk of having a baby with a chromosomal abnormality are so low there, why take the risk of harming the pregnancy that's in all likelihood normal?
Back here.
Okay, I just want to share that.
Absolutely.
What is the medical thinking about that phenomenon, that so often once a couple has adopted or even arranged to adopt before the child is with them, they become pregnant after years of trying unsuccessfully? Is there a psychological factor involved? What's going on?
Usually there's no good explanation.
It is a phenomenon that's recognized, though, right, medically?
Well, if you look, everybody recognizes that it's happened. But then again, if you try to really separate out and do a scientific study of conception times for people who have been infertile for years, there are practically as many surprises in people who didn't adopt a child as do. So,
but we don't talk about the irony then.
Then you don't talk about the irony, so yeah. It doesn't get spread around. So it's probably, although everybody knows somebody to whom it happened, doctors for years took that to mean reasons that you tell people, you're not relaxing enough, go on a vacation, et cetera, et cetera. Most of the medical...
You're not doing it right.
Right. Most of the scientific information is that doesn't hold any water. That telling folks to relax is not going to help them get pregnant. Telling them to relax and be happy despite their problem is probably good advice, but I don't think it really helps them get pregnant. No, there's people who would choose, in order to alleviate anxiety, that you happen to be 41 years old and you're really worried this baby has Down syndrome and you want to make sure it doesn't. And I recognize that as reasons. However, I tell that person, you know, there is a risk in doing it, and if you aren't going to do anything with the information when you get it other than feel good, do you really want to put the baby to that risk? Mm-hmm. And if they say yes, then yes, it's a reason, it's an adequate reason. But I think if you put a baby at risk for something that you're then not going to utilize the information in any kind of action, you got to sort of counsel against that.
Is it back here? Yeah.
In addition to the board, a fifth way to get a baby that's been talked about is in vitro fertilization of a surrogate mother. Has that ever really been done or just talked about?
With an egg from a woman outside the couple.
Right. The couple would supply both the sperm and the egg. Then they would put that in the surrogate mother. But then it would be genetic to their baby.
Okay. That's technically possible. I'm not aware that anybody in any has accomplished it.
I just wanted to talk about it. I didn't know anywhere else.
That's a fifth thing. 2 years from now, we'll probably be talking about that, right? It can be done and will be done in the future.
The population in whom that's going to be done is in somebody who's had a hysterectomy but still has her ovaries, who could make use of somebody else's uterus, you know.
Instead of the test tube, it's another woman's uterus.
Well, you'd still have to get them started in the test tube, if you will. Then you could transplant them into another woman who could bear the child for you. That's another variation on a theme that currently is of, I don't know that it's been done, but technically possible.
Is it true that the incidence of infertility is increasing?
Yes.
Can you say something about that?
Well, there's a couple reasons. The biggest one was the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. Because the one major factor of infertility that's increasing is tubal factor infertility, which is a result of sexually transmitted diseases knocking off the fallopian tubes. That is one of the largest reasons. And the other secondary reason is the decision to postpone childbearing, because if you take a 40-year-old woman who is normally ovulating, her husband's making normal sperm, her tubes are open, and her fertility rate is well below the 90% expected out of a woman using unprotected intercourse for a year. It's more like 15% of those women would get pregnant. So why? Darned if I know. I wish we did. But for some reason, despite all the measurable factors of fertility being normal, people become less fertile with age. And so that's another factor, but probably does not play as large a role as the tubal factor in the increasing rate of infertility. You're getting the ethics of this.
Well, I want to, in the time remaining, which is only about 10 minutes, I want to steer us toward some of the ethical judgments or conclusions that are drawn by three ethicists, two men and a woman, in this book. And I'll just read you brief excerpts on three of the issues. Not artificial insemination by husband, which is not viewed as an ethical issue. I mean,
In the chapter on artificial insemination, Ed Schneider dismisses that at the beginning as not posing ethical problems, at least in his mind. Then he goes on to AID, or what is now called TDI. So let me read what Ed Schneider says in conclusion about artificial insemination by a donor. He is basically opposed to it. And these are his words. I would argue that we cannot separate the meaning of personal and human, those two words, from physical bodily processes. Paul Ramsey is right. Paul Ramsey is another ethicist he quotes. Is right when he contends, we need rather the biblical comprehension that man, humanity, is as much the body of his soul as the soul of his body. The single word sarx in the one flesh unity of marriage, that's a biblical Greek word, the one flesh unity of marriage and parenthood is sufficient to impel us to think with the Jews and Christians in all ages who have affirmed a unity between the vocations of soul and body. Then Ed goes on, AID cannot be ethically accepted simply because, like other good technologies, it works. That is, you can't accept it ethically just because it works. That is, because it's efficient. That is, because it gives a child to a childless couple. From the standpoint of ethics, we need to be concerned not only about right ends, but also about correct means. This is another area where the question, does the end justify the means, could be part of the discussion. He goes on, in this case, the means violate the fundamental meaning of sexual intercourse within the covenant of marriage. Even when the husband consents, AID signifies less than an unreserved commitment to share another's life, for better or worse, in sickness and in health. None of these ethical objections should be construed, of course, in such a way as to cast a moral shadow on the child who has been so conceived. Nor does AID fall into the category of some unforgivable sin. But on the basis of the above considerations, a couple who find themselves childless because of male infertility are better advised either to come to terms with their childlessness or to seek children through adoption. Now that's Ed Schneider's opinion. You don't need to agree with it, of course. On in vitro fertilization,
if you can't. What does he think of illegitimate children then? He rates illegitimate children as being lower than human beings and non illegitimate children?
Oh, I don't think so. No, he says very clearly.
Illegitimate children is really that different on how a surrogate mother and adoption are really that different.
No, he's talking about the decision made by a couple, not the moral character of the child that results. That's very clear. He's not casting any judgment on the moral character. Well, he may be raising. He's saying, if I, as a counselor, have this question posed to me, here's how I would respond. That's what I take it he's saying. And I don't want to speak for him, but if you want to do dialogue with him, get the book. On in vitro fertilization. I told you who Ed Schneider is. This is Paul Gersild, who is academic dean and professor of ethics at Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina, a school of the LCA. Ed is an ALC pastor. The Gersild conclusion includes these words. The argument to allow IVF, in vitro fertilization, but to surround it with restrictions does pose problems, for our society may not share a moral consensus on what those restrictions should be. Yet I believe that the public debate raised by this issue could be helpful in clarifying some basic issues concerning our understanding of marriage and the family and what the character of human life is to be. One boundary that appears feasible to me would be to limit IVF to married couples who desire a child of their own lineage. This would mean that sperm and ova banks would not be allowed, and embryo storage would be limited to facilitating second and third embryo transfers for such couples. I'm not sure I know what that means. I'm sure you do. Okay. The concern here is to resist those inclinations that turn human life in its early stages into a product designed to satisfy a consumer-oriented society. We're going to get a baby by any means possible. While some would argue that the critical threshold has been crossed already by any utilization of IVF, I believe a significant dividing line based on moral concerns can be drawn on the above basis. That is, limiting it to the couple, but using outside the uterus means of development of the fetus. At this point, it appears likely that satisfying the understandable desire of a relatively few infertile couples to have a child of their own lineage is a sufficient value to bear the attendant risks. So with that limitation, he comes out in favor of using IVF. Okay, the third one is surrogate motherhood, and this is by Janet Dickey McDowell, who teaches religion at Roanoke College, Salem, Virginia. Janet McDowell says, on surrogate motherhood, taken as a whole, does surrogate motherhood appear to be an arrangement Christians would condemn, condone, or applaud? The picture is a mixed one, but the majority of the evidence leans against. Wholesale condemnation may not be appropriate, but Christian perceptions of the significance of procreation and its place within the marital relationship are not compatible with the basic premise of surrogate motherhood, that one could deliberately conceive and bear a child with no commitment either to the child or to its father. From the perspective of the infertile couple, surrogate motherhood may appear to be a tempting solution to a heart-wrenching problem, and the child that would result would experience the awesome gift of life. But do these benefits really outweigh or justify the distortion of procreation that makes them possible? She's saying surrogate motherhood is a distortion of procreation. Ultimately, this is a judgment that might best be left to individual conscience, but it should be a conscience informed by the Christian community and the Bible. Parenthood is affirmed as good, but only when it is kept in perspective. There's a grave danger faced by all parents, but heightened by the desperation felt by infertile couples, the danger that a child may replace God as their center of value and meaning. In other words, that the child, having a child itself, becomes like a god. Children are wonderful gifts entrusted by God, but they are not gifts to be sought at any price. For most people, the cost of creating a child through surrogate motherhood costs to the integrity of the marriage, to the surrogate's self-understanding, and perhaps to the child, are simply too high. That's where she comes out. Now, any response to any of that or any of what we've been talking about for the last 50 minutes?
I was wondering if Roger could comment on the, you said you did know about that.
Second and third transfer. What is that?
Okay. In the technique for in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer, you increase your success rate with the number of embryos that you put back inside a woman's uterus. There obviously is an endpoint to that, because you also don't want to have 7 or 8 children.
You could set a world record.
No thanks.
No thanks.
Anyway, and so this not being an exact science, you shoot for as many eggs as you can possibly get. And so you stimulate for as many eggs as you can possibly get. And then when you get them in the laboratory, you can't tell by looking at them which ones are going to fertilize and which ones aren't, so you fertilize them all. And then in the patients who get pregnant particularly, there's an uncanny knack of them to have several leftover embryos, in terms of you've already put 6 back in the uterus and you still have 6 or so in the laboratory that you need to save for another attempt in case the patient didn't get pregnant. Because at about 6 embryos going back in, your rate of multiple pregnancy increases unacceptably. So now you have the quandary of what do you do with 6 embryos. You know, this is one of the things that I'm really intrigued by the book at condemning IVF, because to me, morally, it opens far more doors to disaster than does donor insemination, in my personal opinion. But at any rate, now you have 6 embryos that you can keep, hopefully, for this patient to use if she doesn't become pregnant. In order to keep them, you got to freeze them. So now you've got a freezing process that's going to have some loss in the freezing process. And we're not talking about gametes anymore. We're not talking about sperm and eggs. We're talking about fertilized eggs.
A new cell,
which, yeah, as far as the Roman Catholics are concerned,
that's
is
a, new life.
A human being.
Yeah.
Okay? I don't know where the Lutheran Church is. I think we've remained wishy-washy. But at any rate, now you're going to freeze that with a known loss of numbers. And you're going to have a loss when you thaw them again. And hopefully put them back into the same couple as this person prescribed in his in the literature here. The people who have leftover embryos have an uncanny knack of being the ones who got pregnant. So that means you're going to have them sitting around for a length of time, which opens the possibility of something happening to the parents, which has happened. And now you have orphaned embryos, which is being a problem as far as he's concerned if we use these orphaned embryos in some other couple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So at any rate, the in vitro fertilization process just sort of puts a crack in the door into a number of really difficult problems. It is certainly technically possible to split embryos and get identical twins in the laboratory. It's not beyond the realm of within 5 or 10 years being able to sex select in the laboratory before you put them back in, or being able to do gene probes to detect several other things. So from a good side, you could take a couple that has a 50-50 chance of their baby having hemophilia and pick out the 50% that don't have hemophilia. On the other hand, we have to be willing to accept what we do with embryos, although admittedly only 4 to 8 cell embryos, but embryos nevertheless, that were found to be defective or the wrong sex or just plain left over.
Mm-hmm. Excess.
Uh-huh. So to me, I think the moral questions raised by in vitro fertilization are considerably more significant than those by TDI.
TDI. So even though in my schematic in vitro is within the circle, you see more ethical problems with it, the technology it requires and provides, than you do with the outside the circle TDI.
Personally.
Probably because it spills out of the circle. Right,
well, partly, but also because you're manipulating new life that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the circle. And that's kind of a different issue than just procreation per se.
And it's less effective.
It's clearly less effective, although the couples that you select for in vitro fertilization have got their chances down to zero. So
nothing else works.
Nothing else is much of an option.
Well, suppose a couple does have in vitro fertilization and they have a normal, happy child and it grows for a couple of years. Is it up to the couple to say, thaw out those other ones in the refrigerator and throw them away? Whose decision is that?
It's another good question. Who owns those embryos?
And how long do you keep them?
And how long do you keep them?
Yeah.
Can you keep them so that the female child who is born could use them for instant grandchildren? There is no loss in the length of time that you keep them frozen.
Instant grandchildren who are really siblings.
Right, who are really siblings. I think that there is clearly a reason here to say that some length of time, in order to not get cross generations, etc., is required. But society hasn't told us yet what that should be.
You can see that we've answered all the questions. For any that remain, it is possible that later in this week, Roger will be available to do some more on this. Is that not correct?
Yes, it's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much.